We could call this talk this. But first, I want to know if there's any questions or anything to say. So we're really continuing on also from the talk I gave a couple of days ago. So we have Inval's question of what's left. When we're not busy. And one of the things that we can taste on a retreat more easily sometimes than in busy life is how what's left when we're not busy, when we're not caught up in things as right or wrong. Is this kind of living mystery or a mysterious living that has as a basic quality enough. A basic quality is enough. Or too much. The American poetess Emily Dickinson said, "Life is so astonishing. Life is so astonishing. It leaves little time for anything else." So we can have those doubts of, if I just be with this living mystery, I won't be able to make it. It's not really a doubt, it's a belief. We don't doubt this belief. If I'm just with this living mystery, I won't have time to make a living or feed myself, dress myself, etc. We haven't tried it, so we don't know, but we do believe really firmly that the living mystery doesn't know how to survive. And it's true that surviving and living are two completely different kinds of modes. But if we could doubt in the other direction, instead of from the mode of survival doubting living, if we could just try how it is living, and just find out if it's possible for living to survive. I talked last time about practice that we can do consciously with our will, as if from the outside, acting on our inner life. I gave the metaphor of like a folk tale with an impossible task, like a pile of grain, that we're supposed to find the one grain with the name of God, or the one golden piece of hay or whatever. And we can find out in our own practice in these next few days of the retreat that we have together if we can survive practice, if we can actually do step by step the practice that is necessary, not just like in order to get that one grain that has the name of God written on it. So that's what we're doing. We're sitting there, we're picking through, trying to find the right grain. We're picking away at our habits, noticing them and coming back to something else, connecting to a color or a sound or a body sensation, something other than the habit. We're letting ourselves fill up with some kind of replenishment by resting and by feeling what's important. But if we can be less busy with the practice and come into a space where we could feel each grain, even if it doesn't have the word written on it, whatever word, whatever name, is covered or made of the name of God. And we keep looking for the one that has the name on it. But if we could experience our practice in that way, that each gesture of practice is already like within the name of God, is already within being found or being whole. And we still need to do it. We still need to break through the habit energy. That's the most common daily need, is we notice a habit energy like fear or self-hatred or worry or loneliness or embarrassment. We notice it, and there's something that doesn't feel quite true about it, and we kind of pause. And then something could connect with something else. We don't know. Maybe I should be anxious, but something feels hollow and untrue, and then what happens if I connect to green or out-breath? And anxiety may come right back or it may float away, but there's something that feels more true in the green or the out-breath already. So that's a grain. We've picked through a grain. We've looked for the name of God. We've looked for the next one. If we could experience those moments of feeling a habit energy and connecting to something that's not habit energy, or being open to the fact that there's not only habit energy. So that our practice is like, we're looking for the grain with the name of God, but we experience each grain as being written by God, let's say. It's already covered in the name, it's already made of that. So then it starts to be, what more could we possibly want to do than practice, than have our hands all over God? And still, it does come the moment that we do find the grain that has the name written on it. So there are these two kinds of moments in practice, two kinds of revelation. One is that stream of revelation, a stream of the goodness in everything, the aliveness in everything. And so the goodness, even in noticing fear and just meeting it, the energy of it, as a kind of playful activity. And then also that other kind of discovery where we actually come upon something that's not habit energy, that is an insider, that kind of has something worthwhile to say, or that is a creative spot in us or in our lives. It's a really different relationship to time from what we've been taught. So we have both ways of experiencing time, that there's a timeless, momentless experience of moment to moment, one grain at a time. That's not the grain, it's just another grain. And how beautiful each grain, how amazing, how astonishing. So we do lose track of the sense of a goal that we're heading towards, but we're still looking through the pile and we're still eventually coming upon a grain that has a name of God on it. And so just because each moment is so full of aliveness and so fulfilling, so that doesn't mean that there's not also moments that have a kind of decisive nature. And just because there's moments that have a decisive nature, that are really turning points, doesn't mean that the other moments lose anything of their value. So when people talk about the immeasurable, it's not only that everything is so vast that we can't, why bother measuring? It's also that there's not any one kind of measurement that works at the same time on everything. So there's the precious moment by moment, experiencing wholeness in all these different forms, including even anger or laziness or whatever. Yesterday I was thinking of following a tradition that I started as a child, a funny kind of tradition. When I was little, maybe about Gan's age, so around 5 or 6, I kept noticing things that adults would do towards kids, everyday kind of things, that I had to promise myself, or I had to remember, rather, so that I wouldn't do them. So I had, as a child, I had the perspective of really being clear what adults do that's really not worth doing, and that I would never do. And even when I could still remember that list and I could write, I never wrote it down. So it's the funny part of this tradition, is that it has no substance. There's no trace. I just know that there once was a list, and I remember one thing on the list. But there was more than one thing on the list at the time. These are things that adults do to children that shouldn't be done, that are really off or disrespectful. The one that I remember, by the way, is about embarrassment. It would be like if there's a group of adults and a child or more than one child, and the child does something or says something cute for the adults. For the child, it's just the child's way of expressing and being oneself. For the adults, it's cute, and the adults laugh. And they're not relating to the child anymore. They're laughing kind of actually at the child, how cute, with kind of love and appreciation, but also not really with the child. That's the only one that I didn't need to write down and did remember. So all the other ones have been lost too. Fading, aging mind. So yesterday I thought of doing a similar tradition and not writing down an important list. It seems like now in the really broadly spreading world of English language communication, like books and internet, etc., we've now had quite a good few solid decades of what we call New Age communication. And there are certain kind of principles, in a way, that are part of New Age thinking, that people who are part of New Age groups know and accept. And then there's all these other people that speak English and read English and write English who have never come across those ideas. So they're really norms for a lot of people, and they're really abnorms for a lot of people. So one of them, to start the list, is about the word healing, and how the word healing has a root meaning that is about wholeness, wholeness, being whole, complete. And this is something that in mainstream English language discourse, it keeps needing to be explained, kind of, that in the New Age segment, we consider this a norm, that healing is about wholeness, that healing, the word healing comes from the word wholeness. And as New Age kind of mixes and weaves with traditional spiritual traditions, there are some of these New Age principles that start to make it into the traditions. So I remember a few decades ago, learning meditation, it was absolutely taboo, absolutely improper and not allowed to do any kind of mixture with healing and meditation. If you were doing meditation, it had nothing to do with healing. And even in the tradition of the Theravadan monks, if you are a monk or a nun, you're not allowed to practice any healing art. Even if you're a healer, you can't, you have to choose. So that's the tradition comes from healing is over here and meditation is over here. And as a monk or nun wearing robes or representative of a meditation tradition, you're not allowed to practice healing. I remember in around 2000 or so, then it was kind of a big step to lead a retreat with a Reiki guy for Catholic nuns, mostly, some fathers also, in Varanasi of all places. That was meditation and Reiki. In this case, the meditation was an add-on to the Reiki, so it was kind of allowable. But now that we start to understand the word healing in a different way, I think it can be really helpful to bring it into our language about meditation. So where healing or meditation is about finding something wrong that needs to be fixed and then focusing on fixing that, that is a kind of, can I say, extremely different point of view or approach as meditation or as healing from discovering or uncovering wholeness. So that would be strengthening our apparatus, our system, and having enough energy in our system to be able to experience the wholeness that is in things as they are. Does that make sense? No. Okay. The first one made sense?
No, for me it makes sense.
Oh, I thought you said no. Okay.
Yeah,
you did Indian.
I live in India.
Indian. No. Yeah. And even with the German, yeah, no. Okay.
German, yeah. The second kind of healing,
yeah.
Like in uncovering or discovering,
yeah.
The wholeness.
Yeah. Gladly. In the second one, I'll say even a little more detail. In the second way of healing and meditation, the main channel is a deep wish to experience aliveness as it is. And so it's not like just a contrast to the first kind of healing and meditation, because it doesn't matter if along the way something gets fixed. It can get fixed or not get fixed. It's okay if it gets fixed. I'm not like anti-fixing. And things do also sometimes get fixed. More often they seem to get fixed for a while and then they come back with a force, or we're more sensitive to the remnants, the leftovers of that pattern. So it seems worse than ever before and so on. But it's these impossible kind of situations that we have are allowed, because the main pull, the main pull is toward what is this? In a way, it's almost like your question in ball, like the main pull is so what is left? what is left. And it is a continual refinement that we'll notice another mantle of where I have my whole imagination around how things are and what really is. And it's another layer between me and aliveness, so to say. And so it's continuing to deepen into our honesty and steadiness and love. And I want to say a little bit more about those three things too, again. But that kind of force and willingness in us that keeps going. So steadiness and love are the two main factors that get mentioned in spirituality. And I think honesty is equally important, but does also come along with love and steadiness. Steadiness is not just calming the mind or learning to focus the mind on the breath or on something. So it's also a question, what is steadiness and what brings about steadiness in you? What allows there to be steadiness? And then you can, I think, almost instantly start to feel how love and steadiness maybe have to be there together. They have to work together, step by step. So some kind of love of life and love of ourselves as part of that. Myself, yourself, ourselves. Some kind of love of that that's not made up, that I'm not just trying to do, but that we find despite ourselves. So in that moment that you wish you could just get away, and then yet you find yourself loving anyway life, and that you're not separate from your life. So as much as you keep frustrating yourself and not and not being who you think you're supposed to be, and that love has a kind of steadiness. It keeps showing up even when we don't want it to. Also, through letting our experience speak, we can, in a couple ways, we can just start to notice that no matter what happens and whatever has happened, most of it is not such a big deal. Most. Then there are the some things that are. So most of what happens is not a big deal. And how upset we get about something is no indication at all, necessarily, of how big a deal something is. We ignore completely things that are actually really important, that have really hurt us, for example, as one example of important. And we get really worked up about something that is not a big deal. And then those things that are a big deal, so they do matter, whether not only the things of where we got hurt or we hurt someone else, also all the other kinds of important. Like inspiration, which we also tend to ignore, the big events of inspiration and communication, like real communication. But sometimes we notice it, and we know it's a big deal. I'm going like this, but it's also, it's a meeting. Without measure. Even when it is a big deal, what happens now or what has happened. We can also check, isn't there still a place of stillness, a place of I want to say the word ripeness. So even when there's like great harm or great communication that's transformational, that could send us rolling down the mountain. Isn't there also a place of stillness that sometimes only becomes available in those strong moments? It sometimes stands out much more in times of need or in times of bare communication or honesty or meeting. So John de Ruyter talks about deep okayness, and I really like that phrase. But I want to call it ripeness today. There's a kind of way that when we come into our own resources in those important moments, the moments of great difficulty and the moments of great richness or receiving or exchange. I just read a mind-blowing poem piece by a Tibetan Buddhist teacher called Chögyam Trungpa. And it's partly mind-blowing to me because it's something that I've been saying a lot in the last couple of months, and I never knew that this poem existed until today. And he just repeats maybe like 10 times in this 1.5-page short-lined poem, do not trust. Do not trust anyone. Be lonely. So that can sound confusing, but if we feel, even if we feel back through our recording of our past experiences of significance, of importance, of impact, when it was difficult, is there some sense of a place that of refuge that was there, even if we didn't notice it much at the time? And in that refuge, is it just refuge? Or is it through necessity we got somewhere in the human being that's not just deeply okay, but is ripe even to meet that situation or any situation? Even if we would wish that situation never to happen to anyone ever again. However small or big, like whatever the story of that hurtful situation was. So it might just be someone looked at you a certain way and it was devastating and you feel silly to feel so hurt by that. Or it might be physical harm that anyone would agree, like that's really terrible. And so then something feels a different kind of shame or guilt or embarrassment or pride or whatever. So what helps us with steadiness and love? What helps us drop the urge to find something else outside, something next to me, or something next in the future. To be enough. What helps me feel replenishment, to feel replenished, in large and small impact situations. So that there's not any confirmation needed for a kind of genuine act, an inner gesture, a moment to take place. Does that make any sense? And are there any questions or comments?
What do you mean by no confirmation needed? Like from the outside, that you have the confidence within you?
Yeah.
When you recognize?
Yeah, well, definitely that's what I mean. And we could also say, even if I don't have any confidence, but something still happens. Because just simply because I've that extra like movement of going out to check if it's okay before I do anything allows a spontaneous action. And so that's wholeness in acting. Instead of going out and then coming back in and then trying to copy what I just agreed with. Was that a question?
I'm having a little trouble with all of this. You're talking about dramatic events.
Everything.
In our lives.
Everything. I think if I go to a couple of kind of examples, it may help, and then see what question comes. But I'm talking about dramatic and undramatic, everything. Yeah. And that gives a kind of confidence, that gives a sense of the confidence a human being can have. Dramatic and undramatic. The grain of rice without the name of God and the grain of rice with the name of God. And no measure of any kind, like of better and worse and time.
I feel not in terms of confirmation, but I think that that it's so scary to just be without all the trappings that I feel the need for something.
Yeah.
Maybe ritual or
something.
So I don't know if that's different from confirmation, but
So another, we could also say that confirmation or encouragement is absolutely necessary. We can say what sounds opposite. And so it's getting to the kernel, like getting really to the inside story of, it's different when I'm in touch with the live wire of being and it terrifies me, but there's a gravitation towards that. And I do need help and guidance there sometimes. And sometimes I have it and sometimes I don't have it. That's a kind of real encouragement, a place where real encouragement could happen and be helpful. When I haven't quite touched like the actual being without the trappings, but I'm afraid of the thought of it, or the memory of it, or whatever. But mostly I'm afraid of the thought of it. So I'm just with purely my resistance to it. My resistance to aliveness. My resistance to what it's really like, which is neither here nor there. So I call this talk this. The name of this talk is this, and I haven't brought that in at all. So the thisness is another Chögyam Trungpa word. That instead of like calmly practicing mindfulness of all those that's, that out-breath and that sound, we're in this. And whatever this is, whether it's dramatic or it's not even undramatic anymore, like the sound of the bird when it's this, isn't it dramatic? I mean, so, it's huge. So maybe it's partly the acceptance that sometimes there is a sense of communication with another person and it's helpful, or communication with through a book or whatever. And sometimes that isn't there. And we can accept that that's also the reality. That sometimes there isn't. The hand to hold. So I want to give Lenny the examples, kind of. They're kind of examples. Were you going to say something, Nace?
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. It'll fit somehow.
Okay.
Yeah.
I am wondering, can you say more about how the idea of trust no one, be lonely, is different from kind of attachment to the self?
Mm. Yeah. Good. I think that fits nicely with what I had wanted to say, and it actually makes a good way to lead into it. Attachment to the self is really misusing a wrong idea. So it's using the idea that there is a self to hold on to be attached to, and not investigating that feeling of being attached, and not investigating the reality of what I'm calling the self, my stuff or whatever. In our experience of us, there isn't anything to hold. There come moments where we feel like a separate person. We feel like a definitely defended, or definitely better, or definitely worse, or definitely something that's different and separate. But then that feeling is also gone a few moments later. And even the feeling itself, if we dare, when there's the courage to be with that feeling itself of feeling defended, what is it? What is there in that feeling of being defended? It's not really defense. It doesn't in any way protect us. So this thing of healing and wholeness and discovering wholeness and the kind of, let's say, two kinds of moments in practice where there's the everyday, ordinary wholeness where each grain is holy, and then there's the discovery moments that also are holy And there is a difference, and it's no problem, neither one for the other. And it also helps us experience in the one and the other a lightness and a seriousness at the same time. And it's one quality I've noticed, particularly on this retreat, that if it's your first retreat, it can be maybe confusing, because I've especially noticed lightness and seriousness and how unlikely it seems to us that that goes together, that it fits exactly and neatly. So one way to take that is that the lightness that is often in the hall and among us is a serious thing. It's an important thing. It's a valid, valuable, precious, and powerful also thing. And that's in my opinion. So let's find in your experience what you discover by giving some room to that lightness that you might have noticed. Or it might have been so light that it went unnoticed, which is why it can be important to feel the undertones kind of. And then also, of course, that there's the lightness even when we kind of take a serious step in the direction of bare meeting, bare being. That there's nothing to lose. Like Nace's question, what about, what does be lonely, don't trust anyone? Doesn't that sound a lot like getting claustrophobic, getting too enclosed in your own little world? Even if we would be enclosed in our own little world, there, if we just experience it as it is, if we actually have any interest in what's actually happening, what is that feeling closed? What is it? The feeling itself, feeling closed, is insubstantial. It has a specific quality that we can notice, we can kind of let it ride along, and if we meet it with openness, it won't stay the same, it's alive. And so we end up not being so closed after all, because even the feeling of closedness ends up opening, has a lightness, has a seriousness. So when we have this question of what's left, and what's left is just this, there can be many different layers in experiencing just thisness. So there can be a lightness that's important, that has its importance. There can be a kind of breakthrough experience that we can let it have ventilation, like there's airiness in it. Or we have a sense of humor about it or whatever. And again, this sense of not needing to measure and not having any tools or unit of measurement. That piece that sometimes is available, just because it's not the end of the story, just because it's not necessarily the last grain of sand, the last grain of rice with the name of God on it, doesn't make it unworthwhile. So it's still worthwhile, and it's not the end of the story. And so for Lenny especially, I want to just briefly go into two seemingly contrasting, opposite ways of this totality or wholeness of thisness, just this. And if we can hear both of them with new ears, if you've heard it before, try to leave some space around the edges. So one thing that can happen when we let ourselves just be this or be with this whatever you prefer. We could really notice when there's really a healthy kind of, as if lying in the hammock and letting things come and not getting involved or not getting out of the hammock for anything, no matter how exciting or disturbing. And that can refine to the point where experience as if comes in and the mind goes so far as to recognize what's happening. So we're not in a blank state, but we don't go any millimeter beyond that. So we could be aware that it's a sound and not a taste. I mean, there could be other states where it gets confused, the senses intermingle, but it could just be that it's just a sound. And you can start to feel the layers as if, have an image of, in the biology, all those layers of skin that have the, what are they, like cilia and philia or whatever, cilia, the little fingers that move stuff along. So we have these layers that are so sensitive, and they haven't been trained any other way other than to get excited and to go out towards. And letting that relax, so this is a kind of steadiness, and what brings that steadiness, other than kind of trust, not in someone else, not even really in myself, but something, trust in nothing, or trust in the wholeness, or trust in the fact that this is, maybe, this is happening, so, and I'm happening, there's a not-to-ness in this and me, so here's this happening together. And I love in the Chogyam Trungpa poem, peace, do not trust, do not trust, do not trust. And then he says, by not trusting, I'll put it up, the poem up. Again, I'm probably reversing the, which ankles are carved and which feet are running or whatever, but the basic gist is, by not trusting someone else to do it for me, kind of thing, or to make it be okay for me or confirm that my experience is this. He said friendliness develops. So instead of like wanting to trust someone and then trying to develop a friendship with that person to kind of milk the the relationship for all it's got, all or whatever, by not trusting, by not falling for the trusting someone else game, by landing in this, I don't exclude anyone or anything in this. So it's another way, it's not claustrophobic. This. And I don't require anything or anyone to do anything to this for me. That's another way, it's not like all about me. And so in that, not requiring and not protecting from this, naturally friendliness comes out. It's more like life juices us, and it's friendliness juice. Instead of us trying to hungrily get the juice out of the experience. So not to worry if you keep noticing, you know, you let go of one layer of over-alertness and over-reactivity. It's totally normal, and our sensitivity, even biologically, is kind of ready that way. And so it takes practice for that to calm down, that there could just be this and that way, that it's we let experience come in and we don't get out of the hammock. And what that does also, by the way, is it, in terms of what's left, is it leaves energy for a very subtle kind of eye that is really interested in going deep. Not just interested, but it just does go. It just gradually wiggles in, wiggles in, wiggles in. So it's not like trying to get my experience just right so that I experience non-separation. But knowing there'll be these layers of kind of slightly on the defensive, slightly on the alert. What was that sound? Is somebody coming? That tree, what? Maybe I need to... And then that calms down and you come across another layer and that calms down another. But just leaving room, staying in the hammock, that's one way that sometimes happens. I'm not saying you have to choose this way or the other way, but sometimes it happens that we don't get out of the hammock. And it's totally okay. And friendliness is a result. And honesty is a result. So it's this steadiness, love, honesty. So in the hammock is one way that happens. And another way that seems the opposite is not just feeling that life is happening to you and coming at you and all your emotions are coming at you and you're just sort of like the cliff by the sea getting pounded or whatever, but something that's a bit interested and goes towards emotion, for example, or it goes towards any experience. So it's not on the defensive, it's just clearly fearless. Because there's not fear, I can go towards fear. Because somewhere I'm not afraid of fear because I've already, it's eaten me up so many times. Okay. So something in me is like, all right, bring it on. And this can happen in that sort of wave by wave. So the wave of emotion comes and you go out and meet it. There's a sense that this emotion is not something I've already done wrong, that I've got to quickly fix before anyone notices or before it embarrasses me, before it takes me out of myself. So again, we're actually already leaving that bubble of me to go and meet an emotion that I shouldn't be having. According to my rules, I shouldn't be having this anger or fear or whatever. It already insults me, it already puts me down. So, okay, put me down. It's happening, it's a this, not a that. And so, okay, this. And again, Chögyam Trungpa talks about seeing, hearing, smelling, touching, and transforming, transmuting with any experience. And he uses, and I'm using the example of emotion. So first, he says seeing. So first we see the emotion kind of coming. And instead of seeing it as a monster that we run away from, or instead of seeing it as something that purely in relation to my image of myself, yeah? So it's not just like my idea of anger and my idea of myself, and then I freak out because they can't go together. But having put that aside, what's left? So then the thisness of the anger. So it's more impersonal, a sense of the impersonal texture, the impersonal flavor of anger, let's say.
Tanya.
Yeah.
I have the impression that when there is an emotion or a situation in myself where I feel this is true, then I cannot meet it.
Then you what?
When there is this imagination,
yeah,
or identification,
yeah,
that this is real, this,
yeah,
is true, even though it's not, but I feel it's true,
yeah,
then it's difficult to,
yeah,
meet it.
Exactly. That's how
but
it is.
But as soon as I see, oh no, this is all bullshit, then I can meet it.
Yeah. Exactly. So I think, in a way, to not have too many words all at once, we can save the rest of the hearing, smelling, touching, transforming for next time. And the main, I'll say two things. One is just agreeing with what Petraji's saying, that I was saying it as when I'm relating defensively to the idea of anger or fear or sadness or whatever, defensively means from my idea of myself, then the relationship is of resistance and being against instead of this. So it's two that, it's me that and that fighting instead of this. And when resistance is less and when resistance is washed away or seen through, as Petra's saying, then thisness happens and aliveness can kind of work. So Chögyam Trungpa says, there's nothing to take over if you are not putting up any resistance. Whenever there is no resistance, a sense of rhythm occurs. So when I'm here and that's that, and not this, then there is resistance. I'm afraid that's going to take over. That anger, for example. It's, of course, we're afraid it's going to take over. We're afraid the fear is going to take over. We're afraid of the fear. We're afraid of the anger. Of course, because that's what usually happens, but it's not, of course, that it has to be that way. There can be that we accept the impersonal and the aliveness of the situation. And there can be a meeting. And so he says, when there's not resistance, a sense of rhythm occurs. So there's a possibility of a harmonious kind of, he talks about dance with it. We can say learning, or the ripeness can come to fruition. That depth can be brought forth. So that friendliness comes. The juice of our ripeness comes through us. So then the second thing I wanted to say, so that you have a little more time to absorb it and feel, is so sometimes it's wave after wave of emotion, maybe not always a stormy day, sometimes it's a calm day. And there's also a way that just in our makeup, in our constitution, in our character, we each, and you can feel it so easily with each other, we each have such a different kind of quality. It's very distinct. Each person. Each person is not just like a blank. Each person has a specific quality or set of qualities, a specific taste, a specific character. And this approach of going towards any quality or emotion or experience as this also encourages us that whatever our character is, however seemingly wrong, whatever the qualities are, it's going into it as if it's not wrong, as if it's right. And sometimes even encouraging, so it's not saying be more violent if what you come across is violence, but saying there's not something necessarily wrong with this energy. Let's go into it as if there's something right about it. Not meanwhile punching everyone, but going in the subtle way into the energy of it as if there is something ripening in it. That means something alive in it. So it just makes our whole story backwards, that we're not like setting out on a mission to get rid of some things and install other things and fix us. But that no matter what we find, it's ripenable, like it has aliveness that can ripen. So maybe I'll really end on this one little image that came yesterday about a particular friend who's in a moment in her life of, you know, like that, finding that right. In one pile of rice, the grain with the name. That kind of moment. And it's a simple image of an onion. And that way of practicing where we're peeling off the layers of the onion, that it would be one of those New Age metaphors and principles that aren't always in the mainstream, but practicing as peeling off a layer of the onion. So you peel off one layer of fear and then you come across another layer of fear, or whatever your character is, whatever your story. And so it's like peeling the onion, but at the same time, the onion now starts to sprout from the inside. So it's not a dead onion. It's just going to be peeled until it's gone. But that there's actually in the core of the onion, it's growing up and it's already green and it's, we can stop peeling now. May our practice and our lives ripen for the benefit of ourselves and all. May our practice and our lives contribute to a momentum towards liberation everywhere.